We do want to make sure that everybody has a copy of the sheet on Isaiah 53. Is there anybody that lacks the material? Okay, I said that last week we were going to be looking at Isaiah 53 because that's what we were talking about from Acts chapter 8. Philip began with that scripture. He takes some information from Isaiah 53 and starts preaching about Jesus to the eunuch. And that would have been very easy to do. We laid out some information about that, but we don't want to see if we can dig in a little more fully as far as Isaiah 53. Next week, I mentioned to you as we were in Acts chapter 8 last week that he was using a translation of scripture from Isaiah 53. Now, that's not something we talk about too often, but I think that's a good time to maybe have a discussion about Bible class translations. So unless things change, that'll be the topic for next week. And then 2 weeks from today, we'll head back into Acts chapter 8. On the sheet that you have, maybe we can just leave a few of those to the back, Steve, as well, if there are not any back there. But we will kind of want to take this verse by verse and make some comments. I put some space in there so you can add some information if you so choose. But in Isaiah 53 and verse 1, the text says, "Who hath believed our message, and to whom hath the arm of Jehovah been revealed?" When you look at information about Jesus in the Old Testament, you find that there are at least 300 prophecies. People count those a little differently. Somebody says, "Well, I think this is a prophecy, I think this is a prophecy," but at least 300 seems to be the number where people would start with. And yet, when you look at about that, you think you have 300 facts about the Messiah, you would think that a lot of people would figure it out. But when Jesus comes along and he starts doing the kinds of things that were mentioned in the prophecies, people just don't get it, at least for a while. So it's kind of interesting to me that it was sort of hidden from people. But there were a few. You have people like Nicodemus in John chapter 3. He said, "We know that you are a teacher from God." Why? Because nobody can do the things that you're doing unless God is with them. So there were some people who were sort of headed in the right direction, but they struggled a little bit. When Isaiah says, "Who hath believed our message?" That is a New Testament quotation by Paul. You find it in Romans chapter 10 and verse 16. That might be one cross reference that you might want to jot down in that section. And you can also make a note of John chapter 1 verses 10 and 11. John said that Jesus came unto his own, and you remember how the rest of that verse goes, John 1, 10 and 11, and his own received him not. So Isaiah predicted that. John in the opening chapter of his letter says that is exactly right. Now notice that other little word there, Isaiah 53 and verse 1. Who has believed our message? Who do you think the word "our" refers to? It's our message.
The prophets.
Well, okay, I think that would have to be included. Prophets like Isaiah. Anybody else? What about the Lord? Who's believed my message? What about the apostles? Who's believed our message? There was a lot of unbelief, a lot of disbelief among people. So, yes, the prophets, Jesus, and the apostles. What do you think the report was? Who's believed our report?
Jews.
No, the report. What was the report?
What was the report?
Who's believed our report, our message, our news? What was that news or message? It was the gospel, the information about Christ, his sacrifice, and so forth. Then we have that expression, the arm of the Lord. We see sometimes God, it's an anthropomorphism. That would be a big word for saying that God is sometimes described with human body parts. Who has the arm of the Lord been revealed to? What's the arm of the Lord stand for? All right, it's going to stand generally for the power of God. Somebody says, "Give me a hand." Well, what do we mean by that? I need your... I need your help. I need your power. I need some assistance. If you didn't get a copy of the sheet, we should still have some at the back. If you didn't get one of the sheets, feel free to let us know. I think we still have a few up here. They didn't understand God's power. Jews often struggled with that, and today we have the same thing. All right, those are some quick highlights from Isaiah 53 and verse 1. Anything that you want to add or ask over that verse? All right, let's move down to see what we've got in the second verse, Isaiah 53. "For he grew up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him." Now, if you don't like something that's in the Bible, and you want to get around it, do you think you're going to come up with some way to somehow be dismissive of it? Just like anything else in life. I was out with Hoggetts, I don't know, about 6 weeks ago, and Ireland Elite Brussels Sprouts. We were at Ponderosa. And you just about have to have me knocked out and put them in my mouth and, you know, manually cause me to chew them up. I mean, I'm just not a Brussels sprout guy. But I was playing with Ireland a little bit that day. You know, first time I brought back some food, she said, you know, "No Brussels sprouts." I said, "Well, my plate was full." And then came back from another trip to the buffet line and "No Brussels sprouts." Well, you know, I was on the wrong side of the buffet line. You know, every time it was something to go ahead and explain that. And people will do that when it comes to Scripture. They will give you some reason why it doesn't apply or it's no longer relevant or we have somehow misunderstood the text. Now, if you're a Jew and you've got this great prophecy here in Isaiah chapter 53 about Jesus, how much you try to explain that away? Well, you would, but what's going to be your specific explanation?
The Jew.
Oh. You don't like this messianic prophecy, so how do you try to explain it away? Well, one of the things that they've tried to do is to say this refers to the Jewish nation. Not a man, but the nation. But when you start looking at this, notice verse 2. For who? He, right?
Yeah.
For he grew up before him. And when we see who? When we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. He, him, his, man versus men. When you start looking at this chapter, you have focus after focus on an individual. So the Jews come along and say, well, this refers to the Jewish nation. It can't. Throughout this prophetic chapter, you have multiple references to an individual, not a nation. All right, let's take a look at some of those individual points. For he shall grow up where or who? How? Before him. If you're looking at that in your own, what would that suggest to you? The Messiah is going to grow up before him. Who's the him refer to? All right, God the Father. And what's that suggest to you? Jesus was going to grow up before the Father. All right, I think that's going to be the thing that we need to pull out from there. He's going to be watching. He's going to be involved with the Lord every step of the way. Everything that involved Jesus. I imagine some angels were watching as well. Okay, then we have this expression, dry ground. Jesus came, of course, from a lowly background. He did not come from a very wealthy family. People had to really look if they were going to find the Messiah. And today, that's still true. Sometimes you need to be a truth seeker to see who the Lord is. There was no fancy crown. There was no royal robe. Some of that came, of course, at the end of the Lord's life as far as mocking him. But he was going to be like a tender plant and dry ground. A couple points from that. When you think about a tender plant, or the opposite would be dry ground, what comes to your mind? Dry ground, tender plant.
Well, a good plant and a weed also.
Okay.
The weeds come out of the dry ground.
All right. When you think about junk, and that, of course, would be a weed, sometimes they seem like they can almost grow out of pavement. So don't have very much difficulty there. But we are talking about some geraniums right now, getting to be that time of year when we're thinking about planting some flowers out there. What happens if you take your geraniums and you put them in dry ground? They're probably not going to last very long. All right, so when you think about Jesus, dry ground, he's going to be this tender shoot. You have there, I think, one indication is humanity. Remember back there a little early in Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, you have a reference to the humanity of Jesus. That is reflected here as well as on Isaiah chapter 53. You then have this too, when we take Tim's comment about the weed being able to grow in all kinds of difficult places, and you've got the geranium illustration. When you think about taking the geraniums, putting them out in an area which is probably not going to get much water, it's dry ground, it's not the best ground, chance of survival is going to be close to zip. When you think about Jesus coming into the world, all the people who were going to be against him, the devil was going to be against him, the odds were really not in his favor, so to speak, if you're looking at it from a purely human standpoint. So Isaiah, as he comes along and says, here's this one who's going to come, not the Jewish nation, it's going to be an individual, and it's going to look like everything is stacked against him. Well, that pretty much sums up the Lord's life. It looked like everything was not going his way. Even his family rejected him. But as you think about a little later in Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9, what God say? Your thoughts are not my thoughts, and my ways are not your ways. My ways are higher or lower than your ways. God said, my ways are higher than your ways. And you see that reflected quite well in Isaiah chapter 53. God said, this is how I'm going to get your Messiah into the world, and this is the kind of person that he's going to be. It's going to be very, very unusual. Then you have in verse 2 this expression as well, no beauty. When you see those words, what comes to mind concerning Jesus? He didn't have any beauty.
Yeah,
Think the Lord was ugly?
There wasn't anything that made me stand out.
Okay. What sometimes with people causes us to take notice of somebody?
Real nice looks.
All right. We might see a man and somebody says, boy, he's sure handsome. You see a woman and you say, she's a stunning woman, so appearance. What else? All right, sometimes it's the physical frame. What about a person's smile? Anybody ever seen somebody who has a killer smile?
Sure.
You know, I think that was one of the appeals of President Obama. You know, when he smiled, I mean, a lot of people paid attention to the smile. There was just that facial expression that he had that was appealing to people. What else? What about the way a person talks? What kind of salesman do we hear about sometimes? He was a what kind of talking salesman? He was sure a smooth talker. Boy, I shouldn't have bought. And that's the kind of people that you sometimes find that are selling things on TV. But Jesus was not going to have those kinds of things. And maybe there was a reason for that. The power was not so much in Jesus' presentation. The power was not so much in how he looked. But the power was in what? All right, the word that he wanted to communicate. The message that God was sending from heaven. Okay, anything that you want to cover before we pick up with verse 3? Okay, let's take a look there. He was despised, rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as it were, one from whom men hid their face. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Jesus did an unbelievable amount of good. In fact, in Acts chapter 10, you have Peter saying while he's at the household of Cornelius, Jesus went about doing good, and yet he was hated for all the good that he did. He had more to give than any person or all people combined, and yet he was rejected. Anybody remember some of the charges that were made about Jesus? Despised and rejected of men. What did some people say about him as the Lord was doing his work on earth? You have a demon. That was one, and you could find that in John chapter 8 and verse 48 if you want a cross-reference. What else did they say about him? You are a blasphemer. You could find that in Mark chapter 14, verses 61 through 64. You're not working for God. You're in league with the Satan or the devil. That would be over there in Matthew chapter 12, verses 22 through 24. And one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt do what on what day? No work on the Sabbath day, but you are working, at least in the eyes of the Jews, so you are what kind of breaker? You are a Sabbath breaker. Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 7. And then do you remember the charge from John chapter 8 and verse 21? The Jews said, we're not born of fornication, but hey, what do we think about you? You are. You are, in their eyes, in their estimation, an illegitimate child. So Jesus was... Mm-hmm. Well, you have the Jews. I mean, it's kind of like that information got out. I mean, it was not the largest area in the world. And just like today, we're probably less inclined to make a big deal out of a child who's not born in a marital situation. I mean, pregnancy, you go back 30 years, and I think that was something that was definitely in the stigma category. But for our country, we've pretty much moved beyond that right now. But for the Jews, you just didn't do that. So when that happened, that was a big, big news item. And they didn't forget about it. Let's see what else we have here. People hid their face from him. What comes to mind as you look at those words? They hid their face. Shame. Anything else?
You probably just ducked away from them because they didn't want to hear it.
Okay. Turn their backs.
Yeah.
We have no interest in seeing you or talking to you. He was despised. The writer said we esteemed him not. We've seen a lot of this lately with what happened in Florida. You have kids who are social outcasts, and they talk about sometimes some bad activities that happened because the child was not looked upon favorably, the child wasn't included in various events, and the kid became an outcast, and he got angry and then decided to act out and perhaps do something that was awful. Being an outcast is not fun. Being someone who is in a place, whether it's school, local congregation, work. Anybody ever been in a workplace where somebody knew that you were a Christian and they didn't invite you to go out with people to eat at lunch, or there were some other things that, okay, you know, some heads nod and some hands raise. And when I was at Hummer, that same kind of thing happened to me as well. Now, again, they might be nice to your face. If you need some help at work, they'll probably do what needs done. But it's very clear that as far as social interaction, you are an outcast. even the neighborhood where you live. It's kind of like, well, we're headed in this direction, you're not headed in this direction, so we'll be polite to you, but that's kind of as far as it goes. And we've got that in our subdivision. Jesus was a man of sorrows. He shed tears, didn't he?
Yeah.
Think of a time or two. All right, John chapter 11, verse 35. Jesus wept, tomb of Lazarus. When you look at Jesus and how he felt about Jerusalem, Luke chapter 19 and verse 41, he wept over the city. Now, if you're a Jew, based on all the things that we've talked about and all the things that we know about with the Jewish people, what kind of Messiah do you want? You want a crying Messiah? What did the Jews want? Yeah. What kind of deliverer? The military deliverer. You go out and kill them. You throw the Romans off our back. And if we're going to have a crying Messiah, that's not exactly going to be the greatest warrior in the world, probably. But God said when your Messiah comes, it's not going to be a nation, going back to the he and the him and the man, but it's going to be one who's going to shed tears. Well, whenever we need or want someone who can sympathize with us, somebody who can understand suffering and pain and being an outcast, it sounds like Jesus qualifies. That's exactly what Isaiah was predicting. Anything come to mind before we move down to verse 4? Okay, let's go down there. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. Now, we sometimes talk about tense, past, present tense, future tense. What do you have here, past, present, future? Surely he has borne. What would you say that is? Is that past? Is that present? Is that future? Past. And carried, past, present, future. Past. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. Past, past, past. But wait a minute. About how many years is Isaiah writing before Jesus comes into the world? About 700 years. So how can Isaiah write this about 700 years in the future? And he's using the past tense. Do you need to go back to grammar school?
He's telling them what's going to happen.
Okay. He is, and he's not just telling them, he's telling them with what degree of certainty? This is called the prophetic perfect. It might seem strange to us, you know, for, and again, you might say, well, that's a lie, but not from God's perspective. We've talked about, wow, that's interesting. Ray, you're flipping the light switch. So, we say, for example, you know, your spouse is coming home and calls and says, hey, open up the garage door. And we're just getting ready to hit the button and we say it's open. Now, we might say technically that's not true because technically it hasn't happened. But if you are so confident, so sure that you're in the process of pushing the button, we might just say, it's up. Now again, we're not trying to deceive people, but we're trying to express a level of confidence that it's taken care of, it's done. And you'll find sometimes in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, that God will use that same kind of thing. It's not a perfect illustration, but it's called the prophetic perfect. And the reason that he did that was to emphasize with absolute certainty this is something that's going to happen. And that was true. Jesus did come and did all the things that we find in Isaiah chapter 53. Acquainted with grief, the Lord became familiar with sickness on the earth. He surely had to endure that, but especially the sicknesses of others. We read about how people were possessed with demons and some couldn't see, some couldn't hear. They had all kinds of issues. But the most important person who ever lived, the prophet said he was not going to be esteemed. If you let that sink into your head a little bit, what does it mean for a person who's not esteemed? I mean, don't we all like to be esteemed from time to time? What about a child? What's it mean to be held in esteem? All right. I think a person's going to be elevated, put up, praised, exalted to some degree. If that never happens to somebody, how do they feel? They're going to, because again, everything that you try to do, it never works out. You never succeed. You never do anything good. And Jesus, he had that as well. Even remember the 10 lepers who were healed? What happened?
Only one
comes back, and who was the one? Jesus said, it was only the Samaritan who comes back. Where are the other nine? So here's Jesus, deity in the flesh. He says, I've got this living water. I've got everything to help you guys. I've, on various occasions, done a number of miracles to take care of medical issues that couldn't be solved by anybody else. I have fed you. I've given you the best teaching that you've ever heard, and yet you don't want to have anything to do with me. That had to be discouraging. People sometimes say, well, I'm discouraged. I'm discouraged in my house, life. I'm discouraged in my job. I'm discouraged as a child. I'm discouraged here, there. I'm discouraged in church. Well, the Lord is the Lord of discouragement. And Isaiah predicted that. Smitten of God. Now, we've heard that probably read many, many times, but let's, because of today's class, think about it a little bit more. Somebody says, I was hit by Job. What does that mean? I was hit by Job. What's that mean? Job hit me. All right, so if you were smitten of or by God, what does that say? God did it. Well, I thought it was the Jews who called for Jesus' death, and it was the Romans who put him on the cross. How was he smitten of God?
He was sent as the lamb of sacrifice by God.
Okay, there was that. But also, if you were a Jew, would you not have looked at Jesus and thought, God got you? You came into the world and you thought that you were going to, you know, catch it by its tail and so forth and, you know, turn the world upside down. But now where are you?
You claimed you were God.
You claimed that you were God, and you blasphemer, you servant of the devil, you drunkard, and you all these other things, you illegitimate child. God finally ensured that you got what was coming. So I think that you have to look at smitten of God from both of those perspectives.
You Tim? Probably looked at him somewhat like Job's friends looked at him.
Yes.
Job's friends said, well, you must have done something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You messed up somewhere and did all this bad treatment.
Yeah. You look good on the outside, but God knew your heart. And finally, he caught up with you. Yeah. Well, and in some respects, even the people who tossed Jonah, you know, you've got to be some kind of, you know, lawbreaker. So, yeah. Very good. That it? Okay, let's take a look at verse 5. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, the chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. This verse has been called the language of substitution. Jesus suffered a penalty. We've been talking about that quite a bit in the Wednesday night class. And that penalty for sin is the penalty that we should have paid. There are four key words which sum up this verse. Number one, pierced. Pierced from the time before he got on the cross, and certainly pierced after the time. He was crushed. Now, that word is interesting. The word is translated bruised or crushed. And when we think about a bruise, for example, we might knock our arm against something, and the next day we get a bruise, and it may not look all that pleasant. Maybe there's a little bit of pain, but it's not that big of a deal. This is not that kind of bruise. I mean, this is the bruise which is crushed. I mean, this is the kind of bruise where you feel like you've been brutalized in the worst possible way. Beaten and whipped would be the other two words that I would use to describe what's going on in Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 5. Our griefs, our sorrows, our sins, what Jesus experienced on the cross, we've been looking at in some detail in our Wednesday night class. He suffered those things because of us. Now, here's something that I did not know. A lot of stuff I don't know yet. But we've talked about the fact from 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 24, on multiple occasions, how the word stripe there is singular in the Greek text. Peter said, by his stripes were healed. Now, stripes make sense for us because Jesus was beaten many times. But in the Greek text, it's singular, and I've said on several occasions that that is designed to convey that the Lord's back was so bloodied, it was so torn up, that it looked like it was just one wound. What I didn't know was this. The Hebrew in Isaiah 53 is also singular. Now, I found that to be thought-provoking. Isaiah predicted that the beating of Jesus was going to be so bad, so awful, that his flesh was going to be ripped to such a degree, it was going to look like there was just a single stripe. It was just torn open. So that was what the prophet predicted. Then we get to the New Testament, different language, different writer, about 700 years removed, and Peter, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 24, also said it was like a singular wound. Anything before verse 6? Okay. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and Jehovah hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. Think again about how some New Testament references come into play here. All we like sheep have done what? We have gone astray. Well, what did Paul say in Romans chapter 3 and verse 10? There is how many righteous? None righteous, no, not one. Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fall short of God's glory. That's exactly what Isaiah was talking about in chapter 53 and verse 6. Think, too, about another Old Testament passage, Judges chapter 21 and verse 25. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. You're going your own way, doing what's right in our own eyes. That's exactly what we find with people. Even now, many enjoy going their own way and doing their own thing. That results in sin. Now, here's a little point that you may not have thought about. Notice this. Are we like sheep? What are the next words? We have gone astray. What's the old doctrine which talks about you're born into sin? Remember that? Is there a difference as far as being born into sin and having gone astray? What's the difference? All right, one, you know, you're born and you just land in that boat because of birth. But if you go astray, what does that say about you? You make that decision. This is your choice. Your actions cause you to do that. So Isaiah, once again, 700 years before Jesus comes into the world or somewhere thereabouts, he made the point that sin is a choice. We do not inherit sin. Ezekiel 18:18-20 would also be a helpful cross-reference in that regard. He says, too, the iniquity of us all, not only the sin, but also the guilt of sin. Jesus paid the full price for sin. There is no sin which is too large, too great, too significant for him to overcome. When he went to the cross, he took the full consequence of sin, and now it's our option to engage the benefits of that or not. It's up to us. Again, anything that you want to discuss before we move down a little bit more? Gary?
One more thing about the gone astray. If you've gone astray, that means at one point you weren't astray.
Correct.
Because otherwise you wouldn't be able to go astray. So that,
yeah. Sin is a choice, and it's a choice that each one makes at some point. Absolutely right. Okay, verse 7, he was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth as a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep before, or that before its shears is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Well, now this is where we were last week in Acts chapter 8, Acts chapter 8, verses 32 and 33. It just so happens, I would argue in God's providence, that God has lined up this preacher, Philip, very effective man, to head on this road, two different ways to get down to this area, and he happens to be in the right place, the right time. This guy happens to have a scroll of Isaiah. One of the things that I didn't mention, do you think the eunuch might have not come to Jerusalem with the scroll? It's possible. He comes to Jerusalem to worship, maybe on that occasion, just maybe, somebody's selling a scroll. And maybe the only scroll that's left happens to be the copy of Isaiah that he gets. I wonder if maybe he hadn't picked up the scroll in Jerusalem. Don't know how long he was there. But I mean, this guy's going to be, when you consider the travel, about 1,000 miles coming and going, and you consider the time that he probably would have spent in Jerusalem, maybe a month, maybe had some business to transact, I can perhaps see him maybe buying the scroll in Isaiah, reading some of the scroll in Isaiah, heading home, and by the time, you know, you've let him be in Jerusalem for a little while and now he's heading home, he might just be at Isaiah chapter 53. Now, I don't know that it lined up like that, but I think that is at least a possibility that's worth mentioning. And now you've got this preacher, he shows up at this time and he begins to cite this passage, discuss this passage with the eunuch. He was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth as a lamb that is led and as a sheep before its shearer is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. And from there, he began to preach Jesus, Acts chapter 8 and verse 35. When you start thinking about this, you have another point that we were talking about on Wednesday night. Let's take a look at Matthew chapter 27, 54. Matthew 27 and verse 54. We've said a little bit about the centurion, and this verse refers to that guy, the leader of what was likely 100 men. Who's got it? Matthew 27, 54. Gary, go.
Now when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, truly this was the Son of God.
Now here's a place where you want to pay attention to every word. You think the centurion could have seen those two thieves? I mean, he was in that area. But it doesn't say that he was watching. It doesn't say that the centurion was watching the two thieves. What does it say? He was watching Jesus. Ever notice those two words before? Why was he watching Jesus?
My version says keeping guard over Jesus.
Okay. Again, I don't know that that changes anything. He's focused on the Lord. Okay, watching over, checking him out, those kinds of things. You have, as this guy is keeping watch over the Lord, watching Jesus, ensuring that nobody comes, tries to take the body, something like that. What's he seeing as far as Jesus' response? Where's the hollering, the screaming, the yelling, the cursing that had to come from the other people who were crucified? I mean, this wasn't his first rodeo, so to speak. That had to make an impression on him. This guy is dying in a way that's unlike anything I've ever seen before. And that was one of the things that Isaiah prophesied about back here. He was going to be treated so badly, so brutally, and he did not say a word. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth as a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shears is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. He had those sayings from the cross. And that had to make, as this guy is guarding the Lord, that had to make an unmistakable impression on him. Now, did he ever become a Christian? I don't know. What was he thinking about after he went home? Who knows? But again, it had to be something that stuck with him probably for life. Tim?
While he was watching Jesus, and then he knew that this this event wasn't about the two thieves on there.
Right.
Because those kind of people came up to that hill and were crucified all the time. That was a regular thing. But this, there was probably a multitude of people there, and they were all there to see Jesus. And this guy had to look up there with wonder that Jesus is up there on the cross undergoing this death, and he's showing compassion on everybody because he's praying for the people that nailed him up there.
Yeah.
He's praying for that centurion and others.
Caring for his mom. This was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And if the guy had any sense whatsoever, and the centurions were known for having good sense, I suspect that he probably did a little more investigation about who this was. Glenda, and then we'll go over to Bonnie.
I was just thinking, I'm glad you brought this verse forward, too, put it with that, because I had always thought of, you know, he was silent before Caiaphas, the council. He was silent before the mob. He was silent that Pilate questioned him and tried to, you know, like, jeer him on to say something. You know, so I'm glad you brought that, because I think of those other incidents.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few times we had to open his mouth a little bit to acknowledge something that Pilate said, but he said the least possible stuff. I mean, he was essentially silent until you get to the seven things on the cross. And even there, as Tim said, it was all positive. None of the swearing, cursing, and hollering that you would find with other criminals.
Well, and there was a lot that had gone on, like the darkness that came over the
that
light.
That too.
And some of the dead, it says that some of the dead raised out of their graves, and some of the people saw them. I mean, the centurions, I mean, we know that they witnessed the darkness, whether they knew about, you know, the curtain in the temple being torn and all these other things, but they, you know, so maybe they were expecting something miraculous to happen with him hanging on the cross, too. They didn't know what to expect.
Well, as kind of a cross-reference here, remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talked about whoever compels you to go a mile, go two. Who were the people who compelled you to go a mile? Well, you have the Romans. So the Romans got some exposure to the gospel. At least I think Jesus is foretelling that. And I mean, that was an illustration, but I think that was going to be a practical illustration. So I suspect that there was a time, probably not, you know, I mean, we think about Cornelius being the first Gentile convert, but still, within that time period, within that generation, word got out to the Romans as well, and hopefully he was someone who finally connected the dots and became a Christian. But yeah. Okay, let's go back and, Betty.
On that verse 54, we've always equated that with the centurion, but in looking at the different versions I have, all of them seem to imply, and those who were watching, and those who were with him watching Jesus, when they saw the earthquakes and the things they were done, they all feared exceedingly.
Yeah, it wasn't just the centurion. I believe you picked that up from Luke's account as well. It wasn't just him. But I would certainly include him in the process. So, but it was, I think that same reaction for anybody.
Well, but I mean, it's like we kind of forget about the others that were there also felt the same way.
Yeah. You just wouldn't expect that because it's like today you see people who are executed in the death chamber. And you really don't, I can't think of any example of where somebody said, I'm going to pray for the people who are putting me to death. I can call to mind some examples where people had some really bad things to say, see in hell and those kinds of things, but just there's no expression of love, compassion, mercy. It's just not the way that people think. Jesus was distinctive. Verse 8, by oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation who among them considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due. Again, Jesus offered no protest. He was like that sacrificial Passover lamb in the Old Testament, Exodus 12, verses 3 and 6. Another cross reference there would be 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 23. The judgment of the Lord was taken away. A couple different explanations of that. The one that I proposed in our class last week was that Jesus did not receive judgment that was just. Any kind of a fair trial was taken away. We talked about the fact that he had six different trials. The six were split up, three Roman, three Jewish, and justice didn't prevail at any of them. And then two, you'd find that Jesus did not request any type of special treatment. He could have made that appeal. He didn't. He was, as we mentioned earlier, like that silent lamb. Verse 9, they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. Now this refers to a couple things. We've talked about the fact that Jesus was crucified between two thieves. Luke chapter 23, that would be verses 32 and 33 from Luke chapter 23. And no violence or deceit. That is, there was nothing like people like Barabbas, the guy who had been released, the insurrectionist crucified with Jesus. He had done nothing like those guys had done, and yet they called for the most brutal, the most horrific type of punishment for the Lord. And then this other point, he was given a grave with the wicked and a rich man in his death. Jesus, he has that contact as far as being crucified with two thieves. And it would be like today, going back to the lethal injection or the gas chamber. If you put somebody to death in that way, what would you not expect when it comes time to bury him? Where would you not expect the kind of person to be buried? Yeah, that would be. What about sticking him in Arlington Cemetery, a prominent spot? I think if that happened, people would be outraged. There is no way, you know, he was a psycho killer and took 100 lives. Let's put him out there in a prominent spot in Arlington. We're not going to do that. We will not stand for that. Well, if Jesus was someone who was put to death in a way which was reserved for the most ungodly, the most vile people in society, you would think, let's put him where? Let's find a hole. Let's find some spot which is undesirable. And, you know, we'll just kind of get rid of the body there. But you have whose tomb being used? Joseph of Arimathea. And what kind of man was he when it came to wealth? He was a rich man. So very, very unusual that that would be done or even considered, and yet that's exactly what the prophet described. Verse 10, yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. Please God. Do you think that means the Father was up there saying, hey, I really like the crucifixion? No. Please God in what sense? All right, he allowed it. God said, this is my will because this is the path to saving humanity. And Paul said in Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 4 that this was God's plan before the foundation of the world. An offering for sin. This is important. When you look at the Pentecostal realm, you find that there are people who will say, oh, God wants you to be healed. By his stripes we're healed. And they will use that to supposedly justify their claims when it comes to physical healing. Jesus didn't die to heal us from physical problems, did he? Didn't die to heal us from AIDS and cholesterol. What did he die for? Spiritual problems. So when it says, by his stripes, or in this case stripe, the Hebrew and the Greek, by his stripe we're healed, is talking about the spiritual problem of sin. See his seed and prolong his days. That is, Jesus, that's a figurative way of saying that Jesus was going to be raised from the dead and that he will never again die. Seeing his seed and shall prosper. That's a reference to Jesus' spiritual descendants, Christians. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10. He has many brethren. The church stands and will continue to stand. Verse 11, he shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied by the knowledge of himself. Shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities. The travail of his soul. Where do we see that when it comes to the cross? The travail of Jesus' soul. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's what Isaiah was predicting back here in Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 11. God, through Isaiah, said, It's going to be satisfied. What was going to be taken care of? All right, the debt, the payment that needed to be rendered for sins, that was fully made. John, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 2, what's that long word that begins with P? Jesus is the propitiation for our sins. That's what you find in Isaiah chapter 53. There is that perfect path to restoring man's fellowship with God. Notice, too, that this little word is important. He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied by the what? By the knowledge. A lot of people say, well, God is a loving God and he's just going to save all kinds of people. That's not true. What did Isaiah say back in Isaiah chapter 53? There must be a knowledge of God. And if you don't have that knowledge, you're not going to be in a right relationship with God. Now, is that head knowledge enough to be in a right relationship with God? No. I mean, you might have all the knowledge in the world when it comes to automobiles. But unless you go out and you start applying that knowledge, you're never going to have a car, or you're never going to have a car that runs. Knowledge has to be applied in many areas, and that's also true in the spiritual realm. And then as we come down to Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 12, therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Divide or share the spoil. What's the idea there? Okay, you go out into battle, and you conquer this people, you conquer this town, and you say, the treasure is ours. This is going to be the thing that we gained because we had victory. All right, Jesus had victory over the devil. He conquered the devil. He conquered death, Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, and we share in that victory. Then here is an incredible thought. What would you say that Jesus' spoils are? Now, before you answer that question publicly, let me throw this out. How much did Jesus have before he came to the world? I mean, he's got everything, okay? So you say, what did Jesus get? I mean, if he's already got everything, then that would seem to be a nonsensical question. How can you give something to somebody who's got everything? But the text does say he got something. What are Jesus' spoils?
He looked death in the face and said, I think.
Say that last part again.
He looked death in the face and conquered it.
All right. Hebrews 2, 14 and 15, that has to be part of the answer. Anything else?
Well, a lot of the things that he couldn't get here, he didn't get here. The respect, the love, adulation,
okay.
All those things, he'll have all of those things in abundance then.
He's been given the name above every name, as Paul talked about in Philippians chapter 2. And then there's the other big answer that we want to make sure that we bring out. His spoils are us. We are the spoils. See that in Acts chapter 2? And the Lord did what? Added to the church. He came to say, I'm going to rescue these people. These are going to be my spoils. These are going to be my children, spiritually speaking. And if you start looking at that in terms of the Christian life, you have someone who came to earth, died for you, paid the price for you, personally add you to the church. That begins, I think, to offer a lot of reassurance as far as what God is going to do for us as far as a willingness to help. Intercession for transgressors. That began at the cross, Luke 23, verses 42 and 43. And now Jesus ever lives to make intercession for us, Hebrews chapter 7, verse 25.